Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we get to hear about an exciting adventure that you had up in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yeah, great place. It's funny. I find hyperbole coming sometimes too easily on the garden show. As a columnist, I wasn't into hyperbole, but here I get more excited about things, this time with reason. This is really the best combination of sculpture park and arboretum garden I've ever seen anywhere in the world. I'm not making that up. It's a fabulous place.
And it is the Frederick Meyer Garden and Sculpture Park
in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is in pretty good shape considering it's Michigan, but they have 20, 30 acres of, there's Calder, there's Henry Moore, there's Andy Goldsworthy. They have a Dale Chihuly exhibit of 5,000 pieces of glass spread around. Mm-hmm. Other names, I could drop of world famous sculptors spread around in this nice park, easily accessible with asphalt paths between them, but not really intruding into the landscape. Mm-hmm.
But also gardens, beautiful conservatory.
They have a Michigan farm. They have a great fern garden. Uh-huh. Victorian garden, all those things.
So how long has it been around?
Well, about 10 or 15 years.
Okay. Because, I went to Kalamazoo College, and, Grand Rapids was right around there, and I never knew about it.
Actually, it's 13 years, because I remember the director's been there about that time. And it's evolved, of course. Things have gotten bigger.
So and all
13
since
years
then.
Ago, there wasn't near what it is now.
Wow.
But they have a $15 million a year budget.
Wow.
They have a staff of 14 and 14 administrators, 130 on staff taking care of this place.
I really look forward to hearing that.
It's a great visit. It's about 8 hours up there, but it's also 70 degrees and no humidity while I was up there.
Well, and I saw some pictures, and we will have pictures on our website at WFPL.org to take a look, because it looks fabulous. It looks totally fabulous.
And I got a personal tour with the horticulture director. We'll talk to him later, Steve LaWare. Great guy, people in the business are.
Sure. All right, that's coming up in part two of Homegrown. Stick around. But before that, we're going to try to demystify composting, because people always kind of think that you have to do something way, way, way special, or something bad's going to happen if you don't, if you miss a step. And basically,
you let nature take its course.
Pretty much. But we do want to understand it a little bit better, right?
Sure.
So there is a great book out now. It's called The Idiot's Guide to Composting. And, I don't frequent those sorts of books very often, shall I say?
You don't want
or the
to find
dummy's
yourself.
Guide to whatever.
Right.
So when I opened it up, I was delighted to see how clear it was.
Funny.
Yeah. Funny, good,
tongue
clear,
yeah.
Everything.
And the author is a very enthusiastic
She's
person,
very
as
enthusiastic.
People will find out. So,
So composting and then the Meyer Garden in Michigan today on Homegrown. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
The sounds of water. I've now got about 8 or 10 separate little fountains going on, or pools of water. And in these really hot days, it's been in June and July, I love to just sit in the shade just a little bit away from my fountains and listen to the water run. And you can buy a fountain for as little as $100 and get that same effect, and you can spend $100,000 if you like. Mm-hmm. But I encourage everybody to get the sound of water somewhere in the yard or in their garden, because it's just marvelous to sit there with a fan and listen to the waterfall and just shut your eyes. And I love it.
Pretty cool.
So sounds of water at Hidden Hill.
A good sort of July thing, huh?
Yeah. How about the Wishes State?
So
what's up?
Well, can I just say that I think that maybe if everybody had a kitten, the world would be a better place.
I know. Well, I got two.
Are they still kittens, though?
Oh, my God, no.
Yeah. Well, now Barney's like a humongous elephant,
He's
right?
He's not a pound over 50 pounds.
Okay.
So we call him Fat Cat with reason.
Barney was supposed to be a barn cat, but Barney's an indoor cat now, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, here's the story of the new kitten. It's been so long since I've had a kitten, I forgot how delightful they can be.
Oh, yeah.
And this was a stray that somebody picked up off the road. Off Taylorsville Lake Road, and Andy and I had been talking about how we need a barn cat.
Yeah.
Because we've got quite a few mice in the barn because of the chicken feed and all that. So just kind of as serendipity would have it, a friend texted a friend who was over for dinner, "Do you know anybody who needs a cat?" And we're like, "Well, okay, we'll take it." So Bandit now is at Swallow Rail, and we're not quite sure if it's a boy or a girl yet, because it is really teeny tiny. definitely taken away too soon from her mother or his mother. But Bob, it's turning out to be such a good cat. follows me and it'll come if I tell, but it kind of keeps us up at night because it basically wakes up in the middle of the night and wants to play. So he's jumping on us and biting us.
I remember.
But what a simple little thing to put a big old smile on everybody's face.
Now, are you going to turn this thing loose in the barn eventually?
Yeah.
You going to get it?
Yeah. And we take her back there with us, but she's so small right now, I wouldn't want to leave her out.
Safe, no.
So we're going to encourage her to be barn cat and house cat. She can come in and all that, but we're going to try to feed her back there so she gets used to maybe hanging out back there a little bit more, so maybe help with the mice.
I hope she remains human friendly, because ours, after a few years, didn't need us anymore. Mm-hmm. We're just in their way most of the time.
Yeah.
Except when they really want something.
Exactly. So, so anyway, it's pretty
delightful.
Congratulations
on Bandit.
Thank you. Andy named it Bandit, and it fits perfectly. So, and it's putting a smile on a lot of people's faces, so that's good.
Good.
All right, Botanica meeting for our calendar this week. There's a Botanica meeting that's going to take place at the Green Building on Tuesday, July 20th from 5 to 7 p.m. And what they want to do is just get, you know, garden enthusiasts kind of excited and engaged in what they're working on, which of course is creating a Louisville Botanical Garden and Conservancy.
It's a great idea.
Conservatory. So if you want to find out more about, you know, their plans and maybe get involved, check that out. July 20th down at the Green Building, which is a pretty cool place in and of itself, 5 to 7 p.m. More details on our website or Botanica's website, of course.
As I've often said, I mean, Louisville needs a botanic garden of its own. There's some great facilities around here, but Louisville needs one.
Yeah, and like they're always places that are such fabulous resources for education as well. So that full gardening experience. All right, if you've got any calendar items, just go to our website. You can email them to us if they're related to gardens. We'll be happy to announce them for you. Bob, we often refer to our compost piles is really
I got the world's biggest.
Yeah.
It's about 30 feet by 30 feet and slowly sinks into the ground. And
I think yours would be considered a cold pile.
Absolutely.
And I think mine would be considered a hot pile because I've got all that good old chicken manure.
Yeah,
it's a little hotter.
I got stuff.
All right. So we're learning more about the ins and outs of composting, and Chris McLaughlin is here to help us further. She is a San Francisco Bay Area gardener and the author of The Idiot's Guide to Composting. She's a freelance garden writer and a regular contributor to the online gardening resources, finegardening.com and vegetablegardening.com. She also has her own website, which is asuburbanfarmer.com, encouraging urban and suburban people to get out there and grow their own food. Chris, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Sure. There's quite a few idiot's guides to different things out there, right? So I'm curious as to how these people found you specifically to write a book on composting. What are the things that you do when you're not writing an idiot's guide?
Right. Well, you know, I'm a garden writer, and what I did was I had put together a different book, and I was sort of out there trying to find an agent and all that, and they seemed to like my book, but what they told me was there was a ton of them coming out like it. And it was, of course, about, you know, urban and suburban farming. And so I tried to think ahead of the curve, and I thought, what are these new gardeners going to need? They're going to need some good soil, because they're going to realize, you know, maybe just how crummy their soil might be. And so I started pitching that a little bit to people, and one of my writer friends said, I think my agent will want to hear that. Because she kind of, you know, is in with the, she's a headhunter for the Dummies Guides and the Idiot's Guides. And she said, that sounds like an idiot's book. So so I emailed her, and she, it was hysterical. Her website was, or her email was down. So she said, call me immediately. So I called her, and she said, you're not going to believe this, but I just had an editor call me and say, find me a composting person.
So it was meant to be.
It was just incredible. I was like, yay. So that was wonderful. And I love writing for these guys. They're awesome. So
now you're on an idiot's radio show, so it's perfect.
Well, see? That's it. And it's so great because they let you really explain, you know, this is not an elitist situation. This is, hey, you know, anyone can do this, and it's not like you have to have some, you know, you have to have opposable thumbs, maybe. You know,
but beyond
it's helpful
that,
to have that.
Yeah. Well, it demystifies a lot of things, I think, too, because people are intimidated by composting, and you break it down very clearly in terms
so
of the
speak.
Art. Yeah. You do.
You compost it very quickly.
So, let's first get to the nomenclature down, okay? So that people actually, when we throw these words around, organic matter, humus, aerobic, anaerobic,
right,
they actually know what we're talking about. So give us an idea of what the important language is.
Okay, well,
composting.
Organic matter, which is kind of always an interesting thing because everyone throws that around, that's basically anything that was once living.
Okay.
So any paper is organic matter. Anything that was once alive and is now dead or maybe even is still alive, we're still organic matter. So you're always going to use organic matter. So things like plastic and obviously things that were never once living aren't going to compost. And let's see, what else is a good anaerobic is actually when there are certain microbes that are anaerobic and they move very, very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And if your pile becomes anaerobic, usually that means that you've got it too wet.
Mm-hmm.
And it can, at that point, start to smell a little bit, although I have to tell you, I haven't smelled a horrendous pile, but anyway, it can start to have an odor. And then what you'll do is you'll add some air in there by either turning it over. You might even add some carbons like paper or straw and break it up, and then it will become aerobic as opposed to anaerobic.
Mm-hmm.
And the good microbes, but the microbes that actually will break that down and not make it smell and make it break down quickly,
mm-hmm,
are going to move into the pile, but they have to have the oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so getting oxygen in the pile is like one of the number one things.
Uh-huh.
And then also keeping it a little wet, you know, to keep it aerobic. And the more you have of these equal parts of these four components, a little wet, air, your greens, which is your nitrogen,
mm-hmm,
and your carbons, which are they call browns as well, when you have that balanced out, then it's going to break down very quickly.
Okay.
Well, Chris, let's factor in fertilizer and soil pH here. A lot of people are under the impression if you have compost, you never have to fertilize, and you don't need to adapt the pH to different plants. So add that into, mm-hmm, the compost.
Well, compost is a pH buffer. So what it actually does, it's kind of interesting. I probably wouldn't say you never have to fertilize. I will say that I really don't do much more than that, but I also don't plant a whole lot of acidic things. But basically, once compost is broken all the way down, it's actually neutral. It comes right into the middle. And at that point, if you're going to put this in an azalea bed or camellias or blueberries, they want some acidity. You know, then you're going to want to add some coffee grounds to your soil or something to raise the acidity level.
How about fertilizer itself? Do you ever have to add NPK to the compost?
I don't think so. I don't think you have to. I almost never did. And now sometimes what I do is I will add fish emulsion, or which is, you know, a nice, you know, natural fertilizer. I do compost teas,
mm-hmm,
vermicompost teas. When you want the leafy stuff to start growing quickly, so say you're growing tomatoes, and they're at that little stage where they're little dudes and they're growing, I will often throw grass clippings at the bottom of those guys because it's pure nitrogen.
Okay.
And it breaks down very quickly. And you're going to really start producing those leaves. I do the same thing with the fish emulsion or, you know, just some natural stuff that's high in nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
But once the plants get to be fairly tall and they're blossoming and then they're trying to produce fruit, I back off anything like that and just use compost.
Okay.
I also tend to throw rabbit manure out there, mm-hmm, although some people would rather just compost their rabbit manure, which is terrific because this is a vegetable and people get a little freaky, but I throw my rabbit manure out there because it's very balanced.
Mm-hmm.
And then that way it gets all the nutrition it needs, but you're not, you know, forcing
overdoing
more leaves
it
as opposed to the fruit.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So good argument for, you know, clearly the function of compost and what it can do to our soil. So let's back up a little bit and talk about the basic principles of creating a good compost pile. First off, I guess this kind of goes back to language, too, because Bob and I pretty much just have piles.
Yeah, piles are good.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, is it a compost pile? Is it a compost bin? I mean, how fancy or not fancy can we be?
Well, you know, and I'm really glad you asked that, because I have people all the time tell me, you know, I'm sorry, I would love to compost, but I can't afford a bin right now. And I'm thinking, what bin?
Mm-hmm.
I pile it. But that said, we have a lovely family of raccoons that live in our yard,
mm-hmm,
and they will dig in anything out there. You know, we can't leave our pet food out there and that sort of thing. So with my outdoor piles, when I say pile, I usually mean on the ground, maybe with a fence surrounding it mm-hmm. all the way, or just three-sided. Mm-hmm. But usually a pile is just piled onto the ground. And for that kind of pile, I use all my outdoor clippings, plant clippings, and I even use coffee grounds, things that animals would want to actually go out there and eat, that I'm not encouraging that. When I use a bin, I use that for my vegetable scraps.
Okay.
Because that is what they'll dig in. And the bin is completely enclosed with a lid. That could be $100, but often if people contact their county, they'll have the same bin for $35. Mm-hmm. And you can go to FreeCycle and put up there you're looking for one. Often people have one. They're mm-hmm. not using anymore, whatever. So, you know, there are ways of doing that, of enclosing it. And, of course, there's worm bins, which is like a completely different thing, but I also put some vegetable scraps in that as mm-hmm. well.
So
for me, I like piles. That's my thing.
Okay,
I mean,
so the most people can, if they're talking about, you know, yard debris, the pile's perfectly acceptable. Do the bins actually compost, or, you know, get the decomposition process moving any more quickly?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't find that at all. In fact, you know, it's very interesting. When those, then usually the bins are dark. They're a dark green or a black, generally speaking, and they'll grab a lot of the heat. Mm-hmm. And so often you're going to have to water that pile more inside a contained bin
okay.
because it dries out a lot faster. On the other hand, sometimes it doesn't get soaked because the rain isn't beating on it like your outdoor one. You know, there's pros and cons. I think it depends on what works for your lifestyle.
Sure. Okay, so you talked about the balance between browns and greens and air and water and that sort of thing. So
right.
Let's discuss the whole brown and green thing a little bit more. One's carbon, one's nitrogen. What are the real sources of this for the average person?
Average person, mm-hmm. right. Okay, so the carbons are the browns. And just to give you the percentages, this is where a lot of people get hung up, and it's certainly where I got hung up years ago. They talk about the carbon to nitrogen ratio. I failed math. I don't do math. I will never do math. I hate math with everything in me. And it used to stop me because people say, well, you know, that grass has a 30-1. You know, what? What are you people taught? How am I supposed to measure this? You've got a handful of this, a handful of that. The fact is you don't. I never think about it. You take just as much of one as you do the other. If I have a handful of straw, then I have a handful of grass. It doesn't matter. Okay. I mean, I just do about 50-50, and you toss it all together like a salad, mix it all up. And, you know, and you want to make sure it's damp like a wrung-out sponge. You want to make sure you have air going through there, which can be turning it, or it can be, you know, another thing people do is pile up some thick sticks underneath the pile.
Oh, yeah.
And then build the pile on top of those sticks.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea.
And the air comes up underneath. Mm-hmm. And what's beautiful about that is if you have a cold pile, which is a pile that really you don't turn, you're just leaving it there, letting it decompose. And by the sticks being under there, the air is getting in there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not, you know, the way it would in a hot pile, but definitely more than just laying flat on the ground. But the carbons would include things like cardboard, newspaper, paper towels, sawdust. Maybe your kids have critter cages in the house or mm-hmm. rabbit cages. Straw, aged hay, shredded dry leaves. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be shredded, but sometimes it's easier not to, you know, because when they get wet, they thicken up and everything. Let's see, dryer lint.
Huh.
Hair from your hairbrush.
Uh-oh.
Toilet paper rolls.
There's not much of that for Bob. But.
No, I'm in trouble.
Really?
Toilet paper
rolls.
There goes
the compost.
So, you know, just having it processed. I mean, if you're talking about, you know, really
sure.
green, we're talking about not having to have someone haul that away and process it.
Absolutely.
This way it's just broken down.
Huh. Well, Chris, you mentioned rabbit manure. What's the do's and don'ts? Can you use pet manure in your compost? Should you do that?
You know what? Not dog and cat.
Why not?
Because those are meat-eating animals,
okay.
And basically they can have a lot of pathogens in there that will make people sick. So not only with you handling it would make you sick, but putting it on vegetables and things, clearly you don't want that in your food. But the more herbivore animals, you know, the horse, sheep, cattle, pig,
bunnies.
Rabbit manure. Mm-hmm. Oh, don't get me started.
So why is rabbit manure better? Stuff. Why is rabbit manure so great?
Rabbit manure is, you know, most animal manures are super high in nitrogen. That's their big claim to fame, which is awesome. I mean, that's going to break down a pile beautifully. That's terrific. Uh-huh. But rabbit manure is stable all the way across. It has equal of the potassium and the potash and the, you know, and the nitrogen. It's really kind of weird.
It is kind of weird.
It is kind of weird because, and I heard from a landscaper who went and studied in Japan that the Japanese landscapers swear by rabbit manure. And there are some of us out here, we call it spreading the bunny gospel. You know, it's... They are amazing, and it breaks down a compost pile so fast. It's ridiculous.
Well, kind of cold. So, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's great stuff. And, you know, throw in the litter and everything, and you know, all of it in there. And like I said, you can spread this stuff on your plants. And maybe if people don't want to do that to their vegetables, I don't have any fear of that. I've never seen, personally, any sort of pathogen effect or anything on my food or anything, but that's a personal thing.
So, Chris, when we use the compost, or, you know, when we're ready to use it, I should say, when do we know it's ready to, when it's ready to be, you know, functional?
Well, basically, there's sort of different stages of use.
Okay.
You wouldn't want to use something that had only been out there for a week or so, because clearly, you know, the items have not broken down. You can kind of see that.
Right.
When compost is actually humus, at the humus stage, first of all, your pile just goes way down, and you can clearly see that. You know you piled a bunch, and you've got, like, inches now. And when you pick it up and smell it, it smells like earth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it literally smells like the forest.
Mm-hmm.
It's crumbly. It falls through your hands easily. You're not seeing all the little things you may have tossed in there, you know, pieces of, you know, branches or food or what have you. Or I shouldn't say branches,
twigs.
The stalks of things. You can kind of tell because it literally looks like
soil.
Any other bagged soil that you may have bought previously, or, you know, it's kind of obvious. Sometimes I don't wait till it's 100% broken down. There's an argument for that. I might have still some pieces of straw that haven't quite gone yet. It breaks down so quickly. I just go ahead and use it if I need it. If I feel like there's extra carbons in there, you know, like the straw that hasn't broken down, I cut my grass and throw the grass clippings on it. It breaks it down. I mean, you know.
How long will it typically take for a compost pile to be usable as soil?
If you turn it, say, like twice a week, if you're out there turning that thing two or three times a week, I mean, you can definitely have compost in 2 or 3 months.
Okay.
I mean, easy, especially if you've already composted there.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you leave compost on the ground where it was, it acts as an activator, and it gets the new pile going.
What about the winter months in the cold climates?
Yeah, in the cold climates, like with the snow, it's really not going to do much till you get the heat. I still would pile stuff on there. I'm not in the snow at this point, but the gardeners that I know do live in snow. They throw it out there, and once the sun starts shining, it starts to break down. But yeah, if it's frozen, not much is going on at that point. So they do have to wait until that sunshine melts the snow away, and then they kind of, you know, I'm not sure how many months after that. I think it depends on when their snow goes away. So, but I would definitely, for them, I would be adding some carbon, because I think at that point the green would be, you know, fairly breaking down pretty fast, and then they'll need the carbon to keep it going.
Okay.
So the Idiot's Guide to Composting also addresses grass cycling, making your own leaf mold, and vermiculture. So there's more than just composting basics. So can you give us a little snapshot of how we can make fabulous leaf mold?
Yes, so let me think about this. Okay, leaf mold is interesting. Leaf mold, what's good about leaf mold is it adds to the structure of your soil. It makes it nice and loamy, which is so nice for the plant roots. They can take up the nutrients and stuff easily then. It makes your soil friable and stuff. There is not a lot of nutrition, though, in leaf mold.
Okay.
It's not like compost. But it's still a wonderful soil amendment in itself. It's just like another part of it. And some people just pop it in a bag, a big leaf garbage bag, fill it all up, sprinkle a little water in there, poke some holes in it and shake it up, stick their hose in there a little bit, and make it a little wet, and then, you know, in 6 months or so, they've got leaf mold. It takes a while for leaf mold to break down unto itself.
Okay, so it's almost It's almost more of a soil conditioner.
It is. It's, yeah, okay. It's more of an amendment. It okay. definitely is awesome. I wouldn't want to steer anyone away from it. But there's not a lot of nutritional value.
Gotcha. So what's what's grass cycling?
Grass cycling is so cool, and I wanted this in the book because it is composting. I mean, it really is. If you use your regular push mower and you're clipping the grass blades, and instead of raking them up or them being blown back into a bag, and then you're either having them hauled away or putting them on your pile, which you certainly could put them on your pile, we let it fall back onto the grass.
Okay.
And that
Simple
breaks
as
down
that.
Very quickly. It's pure nitrogen.
Sure.
And a lot of people worry that, because I guess there was a rumor a while back that it causes thatch, which it absolutely
doesn't. Yeah.
Stolons and buildup of that sort of stuff makes thatch. But the grass blades break down quickly, and you're actually, you know, it's a green compost, and you're actually fertilizing your lawn.
All right. Sounds great. It's so many good pieces of information on how we can better use what we actually have to create something that can feed our plants and make our garden healthier so we don't have to go out and buy it.
Exactly.
It's great.
Yeah. And it's to me, it's the ultimate green. I mean, making more earth is pretty much the greenest thing I think you can do.
I'd say so.
Make more planet.
Right.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. We appreciate
it. Thank you so much.
Chris McLaughlin is a San Francisco Bay Area gardener and the author of The Idiot's Guide to Composting. You can see her work at asuburbanfarmer.com, where she encourages urban and suburban gardeners to grow their own food. And, of course, for more information on composting and Chris's book, please see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, Bob visits the Meyer Garden and Sculpture Park in Grand Rapids, Michigan. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill, and I'm just trying to catch my breath, if not get my total act together. After the experience we just had, we are in Grand Rapids, Michigan, at the Frederick Meyer Garden and Sculpture Park outside of Grand Rapids. And I've been to a lot of places in the country. I've been to Minnesota Landscape Arboretum and the St. Louis Botanic Garden and Winter Tour and Longwood in the Pacific Northwest. There is nothing like this place in the United States that I've ever seen in terms of combining art and garden and just nature and the whole thing. And got the perfect guest to explain all this. He's Steve LaWare. He's director of horticulture here at the garden. He's going to tell us all about it in 25 words or less. Steve, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's been nice having you all here today and being able to tour around and look at this stuff here.
Yeah, Steve is more proof that there's gardening has the greatest people in the world. He dropped his job and pushed things back an hour just to give us a little tour here, and we really appreciate that. First, some history of the garden. What is this place and how did it get here?
Well, the garden's just celebrated its 15th anniversary this past April, 2010. And so in 15 short years, we've put together what you see here. And there's 130-some-odd acres of property here at the gardens. And we've got indoor and outdoor gardens. And inside, we've got things like the Lena Meyer Conservatory, an arid house, a Victorian garden parlor, and a seasonal display house. Outside, there's all sorts of different gardens. We've got an English bulb and perennial garden. There's a Gwen Frostick woodland shade garden, children's garden, sculpture park, farm garden. There's something for everybody here.
And adding to that, this particular time, is an exhibition. It's all over the place by Dale Chihuly, who does a lot of, well, it's not fair to say does a lot of glass because it's just kind of world-class glasswork. He's got towers, he's got balls, he's got all kinds of things. Tell us a little about how that's integrated into the landscape here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've got 15 different sites, and a site can be anything from the Heckman Pond outside to the Tropical Conservatory inside. This art is spread throughout the gardens. And one of the really exciting pieces of this is the fact that this artwork is in the garden. So the gardens themselves create the walls and the floor and the ceiling and the windows and the doors for this artwork. And as our season progresses, all of these background changes just highlight and contribute to the beautiful colors that you see in this glass work. And as you mentioned, there's everything from huge glass floating spheres out in the waterfall garden, to, you know, 30-foot towers of neon out in the sculpture park. And it's just a truly unique exhibit, and it's going to be here through the end of September.
And one of them lights up, I believe.
Yeah, the pieces, you know, they naturally catch the sunlight, of course, being made out of glass. But there is some of the work that Dale Chihuly has done that's made out of neon, bent neon glass tubing. And so there are a couple of those things that are lit. There's the neon tumbleweeds that are in the indoor arid house. And then there's the saffron tower, which is a large neon tower that's out in the sculpture park area.
Okay, let's walk through this these 15 places, maybe one at a time. We'll catch at least 8 or 10 of them. We began in the arid house. Explain what's there.
Well, the different gardens inside, you know, we've got the arid house, which is set up as the New World and the Old World. So you've got the New World Americas there with true cactus in that room. And then you pass underneath a rock archway, and then you're in the Old World arid, Africa and the arid islands, and things like jade and other types of succulents that you'll find in that area.
And we saw large, wonderful blue pots filled with carnivorous plants here in Michigan, of all places.
Right, yeah, we've got our carnivorous plant house that highlights a lot of the carnivorous plants that you'd see around the world, including some of those that are native to the United States and even Michigan.
Yeah, and they've also got a big conservatory here, and we've done stories in the past on Victorian-era gardens and how the ferns became popular and how the Europeans were building these enormous conservatories to keep these things up. But also here in Michigan, they've got the big conservatory. Tell us what's in there.
Yeah, the Liedemeyer Conservatory is pretty neat. It's got about a 15,000 square foot footprint. It's 5 stories tall. And the piece that I really love about that structure is that there's no central support column. So it's wide open from wall to wall in there. And there's a small river that runs through it, a waterfall, wonderful tropical plants, everything from huge Bismarckia palm to economic crops like chocolate trees and breadfruit and bananas.
So it's 20 below here in January, and folks can come and look at the conservatory and enjoy that part of it, too.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when the snow is flying, you walk into that conservatory, and the walls might as well drop away, and you might as well be outside in the tropics someplace. That's also the location that, for March and April, every spring, we have our butterfly exhibit. So you walk into that room, that 5-story room, in March and April, and there's thousands of butterflies, tropical butterflies, that are flying around you.
And outside, there's flowing beds of perennials, and they have a really big staff here. They have 14 full-time and I think 130 or so beyond that, and hundreds of volunteers that keep the perennial beds up. And they're about maybe a month behind us, so it's kind of fun to see things again that we saw down in Louisville in May and June. But talk about your perennial borders and beds and how you pick the plants.
Well, you know, there's a long-range planning group, you know, that does a lot of that. But it's a lot of fun because the individual staff, the gardeners responsible for the individual areas, really do a big part of steering that ship in those areas. So during the winter, while we're plowing snow and pruning trees, the staff is coming up with different designs and things for the following year. So our horticulture, our professional horticulture staff is really world-class, and they do the lion's share of that design work.
Name some of the flowers people might see here, say, in July and into August, even.
Boy, you know, anytime you come, you're going to see, you know, hundreds of different plants, many of which are flowering. So if we pick just one garden, for example, you know, you walk into the English perennial and bulb garden, and late summer, you've got everything from the native prairie-type plant material that's been brought into cultivation that will be blooming to things like torch lilies and I'll just, you know, it's any number of things that will be blooming out there.
And the nice thing about that is there's these winding paths that you can take, kind of asphalt paths that just don't really intrude on the landscape. They're part of it. And you walk around in little nooks and crannies and you'll see these wonderful flower beds or this waterfall. Then you dip off to the side, and here's some world-class sculpture staring in the face or looking up 30, 40 feet above you in all sorts of bright colors, hidden away, perfectly tucked away in these corners that makes this place even more interesting and really fun to visit. And of course, there's the children's garden there, which has everything possible a kid could possibly enjoy, including kids about my age and size.
Yeah, the children's garden is a lot of fun. It's set up so there's only one way in and one way out. So it's a great, safe area for kids to explore and play and to learn, even when they don't know they're learning. You know, there's the Kids Sense Garden, where kids can experience plant material through all five of their senses. There's a Great Lakes Garden. There's a Treehouse Village, where you get up into the canopies of the trees. There's a labyrinth and a maze, butterfly maze, all sorts of fun stuff for kids to explore and experience.
Let me back you up on the Great Lakes ponds. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, those are set up. They're raised water feature that is shaped like the Great Lakes. So you can be standing in the Upper Peninsula, or you can be standing in Michigan or in Indiana or in Ohio and be right adjacent to the corresponding Great Lake. And then if you walk around above those, you can actually stand on an overlook and you can look down on those Great Lakes, and the flow of that water follows very precisely the same flow that we see going through our own Great Lakes. So you can see Niagara Falls and some of the other areas as that water flows through those Great Lakes.
And how big are these lakes?
They're people size. So the whole area is probably about a quarter of an acre. And you can walk in amongst the different states and experience the Great Lakes like a giant walking through.
And off in the distance is the wetlands, before we get to the woodland garden, but there's a wetlands area. I think it's about 30 acres in the back. It's also got some of the Dale Cholula balls and stuff floating around in there. But you just kind of look, you peek through, and here's this interesting place. Talk about that.
Yeah, the wetland is a really neat wild area. A lot of people really enjoy walking through the wetlands. We've got a boardwalk that runs along the edge of the wetlands, and great opportunity to see mink and muskrat and different waterfowl. There's duck boxes that are out on the water that if you're lucky, you'll see activity in. So very beautiful natural area that comprises about 30 acres of our property.
And to bring the historical component back into focus here, somewhere on the backside we were, or close to the backside, there's a replica of an old Michigan farm from the 1930s with the original barn and the house, I guess, where Mrs. Meyer grew up. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's the Michigan Farm Garden, and it's set up to be reminiscent of a 1930s farm garden, back in the time when you could support your family on 40 acres. And so the house itself is a 2/3 scale replica of the house that Lena Meyer, formerly Lena Rader, grew up in. The barn was moved to our property from another location in Michigan, and it's a historic barn. There's a heirloom vegetable garden, a corn crib, all sorts of things that you'd find on a 1930s farm plot.
Yeah, there's like 40 to 50 pieces of architecture and art outside. Enormous, wonderful, world-class things again. But also there's a main administration building here with a lot of interesting art inside it too.
There is, yep. In our main building that's connected to all the indoor conservatories, we've actually got formal galleries. And in those three gallery spaces, there's four different exhibits that happen every year, rotating exhibits. And just wonderful legacy exhibit is going on right now, where we've invited many of the artists that are in our permanent collection to display a temporary piece. And this is all in tribute to Fred and Lena Meyer. It's called the Legacy Exhibit, which is going on in our galleries right now. And just wonderful, wonderful artwork in the galleries.
Yeah, we shouldn't neglect the Meyers. After all, their name is on this thing. It's the Meyers stores that we all know, but connect them to this place. Give me some history about them and how this all happened.
Well, Fred and Lena Meyer are local Michigan folk. Their original store was just north of here in Greenville, Michigan. And our property was actually donated by the Meyer family. Fred Meyer was an avid art collector, but he was a collector for the people. He wasn't a collector for himself. He really wanted to have this artwork available for the public. So he was approached by the West Michigan Horticultural Society, and they came up with a plan to have a garden and then sculpture on display within those gardens, and it's really evolved from there.
And both of them are still alive, and they're still pretty active in this whole facility.
They are, yep. Fred and Lena Meyer are both very much alive, and we enjoy visits from them on a very regular basis. They're very wonderful, kind people.
And also you have, well, they've shows that they have a 1,750-seat amphitheater outdoors. But in front of the stage is this wonderful run of perennial flowers. As Steve said, you know you're in a sculpture garden, in a flower garden, even if you're an outdoor concert, because you can't miss it. It's just everywhere around you. But you've had Lyle Lovett here and other people, too.
Yeah, absolutely. We have everybody from B.B. King, Melissa Etheridge, Lyle Lovett, all sorts of fantastic acts that people are interested. They can see more about that on our website. But we've got between 12 and 14 concerts every season here, and it's a wonderful outdoor venue to see a show.
And you've been here over the 13 years, the evolution, because it's only been open 15 in itself. So talk about the evolution of where it started, where it is now, and where you guys want to take this place.
Well, you know, I've been fortunate to be here since 1997, and it's really been an amazing ride thus far. To see where we are now is just been a great experience. And for the future, you know, we've got things on our plans, everything from, you know, potential for Gardens of the World to future exhibits for both horticulture and art. Things are always evolving here. And, you know, if the last 15 years has been any indication of where we're going, you know, it's going to continue to be just a wonderful ride.
Where would you see this place 15 years from now? Do you have any, you think you must lay in bed at night and think, oh my God, what next?
Right. Well, you know, for me as the director of horticulture, we've grown very quickly here. You know, we've seen a lot happen in 15 years. And for me, one of the focuses moving forward is really paramount horticulture. To take, you know, what's relatively new, you know, even the, you know, most of the trees here, you know, we've got several large trees out on the grounds, but, you know, to really mold and to watch these things progress horticulturally and to see these gardens come into their own and really continue to move forward in excellent horticultural practices.
And you're open every day of the year?
We are. Every day of the year with the exception of three. We're closed on Christmas, New Year's, and Thanksgiving Day.
And the present exhibit will be here through September?
Yep, Chihuly will be here through the end of September. And there's something to see here all year round. We've got a wonderful Christmas Around the World and Holiday Traditions exhibit that goes on Thanksgiving through New Year's. We've got the Spring Butterfly exhibit that I talked about for March and April. There's a Color Fall exhibit in the fall that highlights chrysanthemums. If you go to meyergardens.org, you can get all the information you need. But we're open Monday through, or actually 7 days a week, 9 to 5. We're open late Mondays and Tuesdays this summer until 9 p.m.
Only an 8-hour drive north of Louisville and worth every mile, let me tell you that. Steve, thanks a lot. You're really a tribute to our profession and having people out here and enjoying this place. I know it's part of your life.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for coming.
Steve Loewer is Director of Horticulture at the Frederick Meyer Gardens and Sculpture Park in Grand Rapids, Michigan. For more information on the garden or Steve, visit the Homegrown page at wfpl.org. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
We have someone that knows beans about beans.
Oh, well, right? You know, it's really cool that we are able to talk about gardening on the radio.
I know.
And when you talk about, you know, your failures and stuff, it's so helpful for other people to say, oh my gosh, that happened to me too.
Oh,
so
boy.
We got a couple of comments about my problem with getting my Tavera green beans to germinate. Serena Hearn, she said she's had the same problem.
Okay.
She got her seeds from a different source, however, but I'm wondering if maybe like the seeds are bad. So then another email came in from Roger Brown, and he suggested, which is a great idea, which I need to do, is do a seed sprouting test. So basically, I put a few seeds between damp paper towels and see if the seeds will actually sprout.
And
if they do, then I know that it's not the seeds fault.
Oh.
That it's some other environmental sort of thing or the damping off, which we suspect. Because I got more to germinate, but it still was not a good germination rate.
Well, I believe in you, kid. So, it must be the seeds.
I don't know. And if Serena had the same problem,
yeah,
it could be a bad batch everywhere.
It's an epidemic.
That's kind of scary because that's my favorite green bean bottle.
I wonder if they could have a recall of beans. Does that ever happen?
Well, I guess maybe not a recall, but they'll come out and say, sorry, bad batch of beans.
They recall
this year.
Cars all the time. They recall beans from time to time.
Maybe. Maybe it'll get to that.
Yeah, and part two of this thing here, there's a rarest of all animals, a Hoosier grapefruit question from somebody named Janet, not related to me. I live in southern Indiana and have a 7-foot grapefruit tree in a large pot that is root bound. It spends May through October out in our deck. Then we bring it into the garage during the colder months. If I repot it to a larger container, however, we may not be able to maneuver it into the garage and back. My question, can I plant this grapefruit tree in my backyard, cover it with something, and have it survive the winter months?
No.
Next question.
And you know what? And quite frankly, it may be just fine root bound in that pot.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Considering what it is.
Yep.
If you consider kind of the art of bonsai, they trim roots and kind of keep roots small so that the actual plant stays small. So if you keep bumping it up a little bit into a bigger pot, you might have a monster thing to deal with that you can't handle. So you might want to just leave it be.
It'll tell you if it's just totally pot bound after a while. Mm-hmm. It needs watering every 20 minutes
this
and look yellow leaves and the grapefruit will fall off and go bang.
But you can't plant it outside. Nope. It won't winter over.
Sorry, Jen.
Sorry.
But if you have an optimistic question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 502-814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What is it?
Another one you may or may not have. I'm always curious about this. You ever grow bear's breeches?
Yes, I love it. Acanthus? Uh-huh.
Acanthus mollis.
Uh-huh.
Yes. I have one plant, too. I really like it a lot. As you know, it's got this kind of dark green, arching, hairy, spiny leaves, and they're deeply divided. Interesting plant. Then up come these whitish purple flowers like a Greek column late in the summer. And that's what mine's doing right now.
They're
exactly.
They're pretty cool. Yeah.
Acanthus comes from the Greek word acanthos, meaning thorny or spiky, and mollus means soft, so it's kind of a non sequitur, a soft column.
There's also a Acanthus spinosus that's even spinier.
Okay. Well, there you go. Well, we're sticking with the mollus on this one, kiddo. But yeah, I love the thing. I really do. It's a native of the warmer parts of Europe and Asia, and the books say it's hardy to zone 7 to 9, but I've never lost one.
Yeah.
Have you ever lost
one? I don't have a problem with it. Actually, sometimes it can become a little robust.
Exactly. Yeah, in fact, I looked that
up.
In fact, it's been called everything from a thug to Conan the Barbarian because it'll just kind of take over in some areas. But mine doesn't, and I'm really glad I've got the thing. It's kind of ugly late winter to spring, then it comes back. But it's got a neat name, history to it. The Corinthian columns in Greece date back to the 5th century B.C. The story goes a young girl in Corinth died, and after her funeral, her nurse gathered a few things, put them in a basket, and placed the basket near her tomb on top of an acanthus plant.
Okay.
The plant rose up with the basket. And
that's the column, the Corinthian leaves, column.
Then the leaves around the bottom of the basket created this column-like effect, and hence the Corinthian column.
Cool.
That's where it came from.
That's fabulous.
Left undiscovered, however, is why it's called bear's breeches.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's ever known this. They still don't know, which inspired a poem.
All right.
Many plants in our world are quite easy to see, like the bleeding heart flower or the weeping tree. Their names make great sense. Just go check them out. They are heart-shaped or bending. Of that, there's no doubt. So how to explain a perennial with sharp, shiny leaves and tall columnar flowers that bend to the breeze, that lacks social graces with no hint of a flair, and somehow, we're told, should be worn by a bear. For thousands of years, this mystery has evolved. No botanist or plant geek this riddle has solved. No author, no muse, no writer of great tomes, no homegrown poet who offered this poem. Not one artist or soothsayer, no oracle in a trance, can find the simplest reason for a bear to wear pants.
You're on a roll there, mister. That was good.
That's fine, yeah.
All right, so if there's anybody out there that knows why it's called
Bear's Britches, why it's called, please, or
better give us a buzz.
Or even a good guess.
Even a good guess.
Any answer, because 2,500 years, and nobody explained
knows
why it's called Bear's Britches.
The Corinthian thing is pretty cool, though.
That
All
is.
Right, thanks, Bob.
Yeah.
That ends another edition of Homegrown. We hope that you join us again next week.
Homegrown is produced by the columner Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.